for all the implicit criticism that may be in the book, we know that it is two diaspora Jews with profoundly un-Jewish names, Esther and Mordechai, that emerge in the tale as heroes and saviors of world Jewry, invaluable actors for their people on the world stage. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 32, Shushan versus Jerusalem. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. In the writings of Abigail Adams, we suddenly come upon one of the most unexpected of biblical references. It appears in a letter to her husband John, discussing the publication of the correspondence of Thomas Hutchinson, the former royal governor of Massachusetts. Abigail Adams writes, "I suppose you will receive two or three volumes of that forlorn wretch Hutchinson's letters." And then she adds, "May the fate of Mordechai be his." The fate of Mordechai? What does that mean? Here, Abigail Adams appears to refer to the Book of Esther, a text well known to Americans at the time. Seemingly, in her anger, she has confused the hero and villain in this eternal tale. She had meant to wish ill upon the royal governor by referencing the way in which Esther overcomes Haman, leading to Haman being hung on the gallows. But Adams had mixed up villain and hero and reversed Haman and Mordechai. Reading this for the Talmudically trained is an amusing reminder of the rabbinic description of those who engaged in festive drinking on Purim, Ad delo yada ben arur Haman le Baruch Mordechai, until they did not know the difference between cursing Haman and blessing Mordechai. This statement in the Talmud is immediately qualified by rabbinic sages who explain that it is not to be taken literally. But in truth, there is actually something profound to Abigail Adams' little mix-up. Appreciating Purim means understanding what Shushan, the capital of Persia, was like. It embodied a world in which moralities were reversed, where a Haman could be praised, where all would genuflect before him, and where a Mordechai could be cursed, where Jews could be targeted, where a queen of Persia could feel forced to hide the fact that she was Jewish. The book, in other words, presents us with a reversal. Indeed, while Esther is often read by Jews as a separate work and therefore studied in a historical vacuum, the truth is that it is only when we understand all that is occurring in Jerusalem at this time that we can appreciate how this book is all about reversals and how it is within these reversals that the heroism of its Jewish characters can be seen. As we saw in our last session, King Darius of Persia, lobbied by the Davidic descendants Zerubbabel, allows for the building of the temple to finally go forward. Thus, it is toward the end of the 500s BCE that the house of God is restored atop the Temple Mount. The book of Ezra describes the first holiday fully marked in Jerusalem in decades, and the children of the captivity kept the Passover upon the 14th day of the first month. For the priests and the Levites were purified together, all of them were pure, and slaughtered the Passover for all the children of the captivity, and for their brethren the priests, and for themselves. And the children of Israel, which had come again out of the captivity, and all that had separated themselves unto them from the impurity of the pagans of the land to seek the Lord God of Israel, did partake, and kept the feast of unleavened bread 7 days with joy, for the Lord had made them joyful. Passover in Jewish Jerusalem, a sacred meal bonding Jew to Jew and thereby Jews to God. It is only with this in mind that we can truly appreciate the Esther story, the Purim story. Darius, king of Persia, is succeeded by Xerxes, who seems to be the king Ahasuerus in the book of Esther. With Persia having conquered Babel, the center of power is now in Xerxes' capital, Shushan. The entire biblical book focuses on the intrigue that takes place in the monarch's palace and on the Jews that live and work there, as well as in the palace environs. And this means that the Jews that we meet are those who, despite the rebuilding of the temple, have chosen to stay in exile, have chosen, perhaps, to relocate to the center of power near the royal court. They have chosen Persia's pagan environs over a Jerusalem that has had the service of God restored within it. Only with this in mind can we appreciate the profound contrast intended in the book of Esther when it describes a party held by the king in the palace. There were white, green, and blue hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rings and pillars of marble. The beds were of gold and silver upon a pavement of red and blue and white and black marble. And they gave them to drink in vessels of gold, the vessels being diverse one from another, and royal wine in abundance, according to the state of the king. And the drinking was according to the law, none did compel, for so the king had appointed to all the officers of his house, that they should do according to every man's pleasure. From the very beginning, the theme of religious reversal, of contrast, is obvious to anyone familiar with biblical language. The list of glorious substances, tehelet, blue wool, argaman, purple wool, gold, silver, all these are materials mentioned in the creation of the tabernacle and temple. We are being asked, in other words, to mark the fact that many Jews chose to live in a city with this palatial edifice of Ahasuerus, this hedonistic form of eating and drinking at its center, rather than return to Jerusalem. Whether or not Jews are participating in this party, some Jews have chosen Shushan, a site of hedonism, rather than Jerusalem, a center of holiness. It is in this court that the king is so drunk that he removes his wife, and perhaps his wife's head, for a purported insult. It is in this hedonistic court that the king conducts an ancient version of a reality show, having the women of the kingdom brought to him so that he could seek a new wife. And it is in this power-crazed, hate-filled court that the vizier Haman, driven by venom from Mordechai, convinces a drunk king to decree a genocide against the Jewish people, unaware of the fact that the new queen is herself a Jew. As the Tanakh scholars Rabbi Menachem Liebtag and Rabbi Yoel ben Nun stress, one is meant, reading Esther, to constantly contrast the world of the temple, the world of Jerusalem, with this setting in Persia. As Rabbi ben Nun puts it, quote, Megillat Esther stands in direct opposition to the rest of Tanakh. As opposed to the depiction of the Almighty's reign and his providence over mankind, the Megillah illustrates in a deliberately exaggerated way a kingdom which constitutes the antithesis of the divine kingdom, a kingdom devoid of any sacred quality and of anything associated with the name of God. End quote. The contrast, the theme of reversal, continues as the book goes on. Engaging in intrigue, Esther enters the king's inner chamber to invite the mad monarch to a dinner party where she will turn him against his vizier. This scene is again meant to be compared to the Jerusalem temple. Rabbi Liebtag points out how the Hebrew phrase given for the king's chamber, the Chatzer HaPnimit, appears elsewhere in the Bible in a description of the inner precinct of Jerusalem's most sacred space. And the depiction of Esther's entry to see the king is, as Rabbi ben Nun notes, strikingly similar, though of course profoundly different, from the entry of the high priest into the temple's innermost chamber, the Holy of Holies, on the Day of Atonement. What are we to make of these obvious contrasts, of this theme of reversals? Some scholars, such as Rabbi Liebtag, argue that there is implicit criticism in the book of Jews that chose to stay in the diaspora. This may be the case. Fascinatingly, as Rabbi Liebtag also points out, the decree against the Jews is issued on the 13th day of the month of Nisan, and immediately after, Esther declares a three-day fast for those Jews in the Persian capital, which means that this fast is taking place on Passover. And at this moment, if we understand all the history that has unfolded up till now, we realize the temple has already been built. It was inaugurated with a Passover celebration. But those who have chosen to stay in Persia's capital and not come to Jerusalem are fasting on Passover, not meriting to celebrate the holiday in the temple like their brethren in the Holy Land. And yet, for all the implicit criticism that may be in the book, we know that it is two diaspora Jews with profoundly un-Jewish names, Esther and Mordechai, that emerge in the tale as heroes and saviors of world Jewry, invaluable actors for their people on the world stage. All of the Jewish people was in danger, and all were saved. Thus, one of the central lessons of the book is the importance of Jewish statesmanship and politics, and the role that statesmanship and politics play in ensuring the well-being of Judaism and Jerusalem. After all, even if the book of Esther unfolds in a time when the temple has been rebuilt, the very same story highlights how fragile Jewish existence in Jerusalem and the rest of the world still is. As I noted in the New York Times, the careful reader realizes at the end of the book that even after Haman is hung, the security of world Jewry is anything other than assured, and that even the swift nature of Haman's fall is a reflection of terrifying political instability. For in such a society, with such a capricious king, could not another Haman easily arise? As Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik put it, quote, if a prime minister who just yesterday enjoyed the full confidence and trust of the king was suddenly convicted and executed, then who is wise and clairvoyant enough to assure us that the same unreasonable, absurd, neurotic change of mood and mind will not repeat itself? End quote. That is why Rabbi Soloveitchik further argues, Esther's story is, quote, the book of the vulnerability of man in general and specifically of the vulnerability of the Jew, end quote. And this vulnerability, of course, impacts all the Jews in the Persian Empire, the Jews in Shushan, as well as the Jews in Jerusalem. All of them were saved by Esther, who is, in a certain sense, the first biblical figure, male or female, to truly engage in heroic statesmanship. Because previous heroes, Moses, Elijah, Samuel, Deborah, were prophets who were guided and guarded by the divine, or kings like David, who sought constant instruction from the prophets. But Esther operates on instinct, reflecting a mastery of realpolitik. And it is only with this in mind that we can understand the conclusion of the book, which reads, And the king Ahasuerus laid a tribute upon the land and upon the isles of the sea, and all the acts of his power and of his might and the declaration of the greatness of Mordechai, whereunto the king advanced him. Are they not written in the book of the chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? For Mordechai the Jew was vizier unto King Ahasuerus, and great among the Jews, and accepted of the multitude of his brethren, seeking the well-being of his people, and speaking peace to all his brethren. The entire empire, including Jerusalem, is ruled by a neurotic monarch who could turn at any time against the Jews. Mordechai, at the end of the book, still does not live in Jerusalem. He stays within the impure world of Persian politics, acting, the Book of Esther tells us, on behalf of his people. And we celebrate Purim, in part at least because we are inspired by the courage and skill that Esther and Mordechai reflect. For the next many centuries in the story of Jerusalem that we will tell, we will meet both Jewish leaders in Jerusalem, as well as those outside of it, who will seek the goodness and well-being of the sacred city. Like Abigail Adams, her letter notwithstanding, we know the difference between Haman on the one hand and Esther and Mordechai on the other. And therefore, to this day, Jews in Jerusalem and those outside it gather every year to study Esther and Mordechai's tale, reminding us that the Jews and that Jerusalem continue to have enemies, reminding us that we as Jews must remain vigilant, and reminding us how, when we are inspired by heroes such as Esther and Mordechai, we can continue to joyously celebrate all the same. This is Meir Soloveitchik, thanking you for joining me. Looking forward to learning together soon. Signing off.